Welcome to episode 43 of Meenal's World. And this week I had the pleasure of speaking to Mihsan Harriman. He is the first black man to shoot a cover of British Vogue in the magazine's 104-year history. And I had the pleasure of meeting Mihsan last summer. I was just a few weeks away from giving birth. And this is something we do talk about in the podcast, our meeting in London when we were, I think at that time, probably in between lockdowns. And I was very lucky because my friend Sahar came to help me out because I couldn't have done that on my own. And meeting Mihsan was a very, very scary thing for me because I've never been involved in any magazine publication. And I genuinely thought a photo shoot with a Vogue would take hours, but Mihsan was so cool, so chilled out. We were done in like 20 minutes, I think. And he was so kind to myself and Sahar. He was so patient with me as well. And when we were in Holland Park, Mihsan and I briefly spoke a little bit about the work that we're doing and the kind of future we want to see our children live in, because Mihsan has two young girls. And I really just wanted to bring him on the show to explore lots of different ideas and just know a little bit more about him. So I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I love talking to Mihsan. Welcome to the show, Mihsan. It's so lovely to see you again. Last time I saw you was through another screen, through an external screen, which is through BBC. We were having an interview on BBC Breakfast when the Vogue cover had come out and everyone was talking about it. Obviously, before that was at the photo shoot, but it really is lovely to see you.
It's so nice to see you, and it's just nice to see you in 2021, because I think we should celebrate the fact that we are here. You know?
Absolutely. And when I met you at the photo shoot in Holland Park in London, you were talking about, you know, your little baby at home, and I still hadn't had Radhika at that time. It just feels so strange to be talking to you now, having Radhika, who's already 6 months, and your little one's obviously grown up as well. How are you feeling now with everything that's happened over the last year?
I mean, you know, I think we all have a long way to go to process 2020. Parents, especially parents of newborns, it's an incredibly interesting time because it's joyous. And frankly speaking, I think our babies save us in many ways because they clear our minds. They remind us, you know, what matters. And possibly help us with the anxiety of the rest of the world. So from my point of view, I remember meeting you and you were bursting with life, literally bursting with life. And even that, you know, you wouldn't know it then, but it just lifted my spirits because, you know, you were there and rightly fighting for such an important cause, but also you're an expectant mother. And it inspired me. And then I remember Googling you and looking at this image of you looking like you were totally alone with a sign outside the houses. And, you know, from a photographer's point of view, it was a really powerful image because it showed the solitude of your cause, how it's seemingly you're on an island for something that should be obvious. So to answer your question, it's been up and down. I will not lie to you and say it's been a bed of roses, even though there have been all sorts of incredible things, life-changing things, of, you know, that have happened to both you and I in many ways. I think we need to be honest and say that 2020 was life-changing for us. You know, and I am still processing. So that's my answer. I'm still figuring out what on earth happened last year whilst trying to be a present father.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, Mihsan, because I feel under a lot of pressure sometimes to answer this specific question. How do you feel? How has the year been for you? Mm-hmm. What's it been like? And a lot of the time I can't answer that question, right? Because as you said, there's so much that has happened, so much to unpack, so much to digest. It might take a while. Even, for example, just being on the cover of Vogue and meeting you, that whole experience in itself,
it's not, you know, it's not a regular thing. There's nothing normal not about it.
No. And also, I also want to just pick on something you said about, you know, our children bringing us life. Just today, it's just coincidence that this happened today. It's one of those days where I felt really tired, just not knowing what was going to happen with a pandemic. And I just saw Radhika smile.
I'm like, she's got no clue about what's happening around her. She's just happy and existing and being a little baby. And that that brought me so much, as you said, hope. That, you know, that our children teach us so much. Our children teach us so much about the value of life and the beauty of life that sometimes maybe if we were busy, maybe if there wasn't a pandemic, maybe we wouldn't have been able to catch these things.
Children, dogs and trees know us better than we know ourselves. Even as young as your daughter is, I can tell you your inner soul, she's directly connected to.
How old are your kids, Miss Anne?
10 months. Lyra, the youngest, and Bella is two years and 7 months.
Wow. Yeah, so, but your 10-month-old has basically been in lockdown her whole life.
Yes. Yep.
And what's that been like for you and your wife? I mean,
we have to be thankful that we have. The ability to, you know, we live outside of London, so we have more space than most people that do in London. In terms of, we have a decent sized garden. So not that it's been easy in the winter months to do much in a garden, but it's incredibly cruel to children to go through what they've had to go through in isolation. It's bad enough for newborns, toddlers. It's even worse for kids, you know, from five upwards, because they're very aware, can't see their friends. All the rites of passages, simple things like exams. Can you imagine we live in an age where children miss exams? Can you imagine this? I mean, it is blooming twilight zone that we're in. So, you know, with Lyra, she's only little. She won't remember this time. And, you know, we like to think that there is no trauma for her, because she if anything, she's definitely seeing more of both her parents, because I would have been all over the shop. So I feel I've developed a very real connection, very selfishly. I've developed a very real connection with her that maybe I wouldn't have had so quickly. And I feel it's a privilege. To be able to spend the kind of time that I have done with my youngest, and of course my oldest, Isabella, who, she's very aware of everything. So I basically work for her.
No, I think that we'll all look back at this time, and it might be very, very difficult to explain to our kids what we've all been through. It's almost like the script to a movie. It doesn't seem real at all. But Miss Anne, you know, I have, obviously we spoke quite a bit when we met at Holland Park in London. So I've been very intrigued as to how your career as a photographer has kicked off. And, you know, with a lot of my guests, I always like to go back to the childhood, because I feel like that always plays some role in the person that they are today. And the reason I ask all these questions, Miss Anne, is as a new parent as well, like maybe I can get some tips and say, like, this is how we can raise our children as well, because this is how I feel that we should move towards a better future, you know, learning from our past.
Yeah.
So Miss Anne, what was it like for you? You were born in Nigeria, is that right?
Yes. Yes,
I was born in Nigeria. What part of Nigeria were you born in?
In a place called Calabar, which I don't think you'll know. And I was only in Nigeria for 5 or 6 years. I have to check exactly how long before being sent to boarding school in England. So I was sent to full boarding, really. You know, very old school. I describe it as Harry Potter without the magic. And I guess it's always traumatic, you know, if you're that little and, you know, being one of very few people of color in the 80s. It was at least my prep school. I went to a few, actually, prep schools were places of confusion, up until I realized that I could find safety in the arts, in the notes of songs, in the pages of books, in the imagery of photography and film. And that became my North Star, if you like. And I quickly developed this reputation as the kid that everyone would come to ask what film they should watch, what song they should listen to. And that became part of my identity. And ironically, I think that was training, if you like, to my life-changing year last year, where, you know, my calling finally found me. And, you know, my calling, I like to think I'm a storyteller. And that can be through my media business, What We See, where we use, again, art and culture to reach people, help with mental health, help with inclusivity and diversity with our corporate clients, and generally scale empathy. Or it could be with my camera, where I try and be, you know, somewhat a custodian of truth, so we never forget what actually happened in the summer of 2020.
Missen, how old were you? You said you were about 5 or 6 years old when you were sent to boarding school. Do you have any brothers or sisters, or was it just you?
Yeah, tons. Okay. Tons, loads.
And did they all get sent to boarding school as well?
All of us.
So did you, were you in the same school as your brothers and sisters?
No, I wasn't. I think most of the girls went to the same school. All of the girls went to the same school, but the boys pretty much went to separate schools. So we were dotted around all over different schools. I would play against some of my brothers in sports.
Oh, really? And what did your parents do, Miss Anne? I think I read that your father was into politics.
Well, not really. He was an industrialist. So one of the kind of founding fathers, really, of the modern independent Nigeria. Went to Cambridge here as a young man. Came back and helped develop, property, real estate, oil and gas. You know, all sorts of businesses, and did well, and was able to, you know, to send his children to school here. You know, in the 80s, which I guess was a thing.
Sorry, Miss Anne, we have special guest.
It's okay.
It's okay. Hi, Radhika. Say hi to Miss Anne.
Hello.
Met him. Hello. You've met Miss Anne.
Yeah, I had the honor of being in your presence. Yeah?
And you might remember my mother-in-law.
Hello.
When you met her.
How are you? Good to see you. Congratulations.
She's saying congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mommy. I'll take care of her, not to worry.
That quiet? Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Don't jinx it, please. So, Miss Anne, it's interesting because you mentioned that your father studied in Cambridge and you studied as well in the UK. So you've got your children here as well. So it seems like there have been generations who will, as in your children, will experience something different to what you experienced and you experience something to what your father had experienced. So let's go back to your father. I mean, to come to Cambridge at that time must have been a very isolating experience for him.
I can imagine. My father was old school, so he never really spoke much about, you know, the obvious racism he would have experienced. I mean, it's just impossible that he wouldn't have had a hard time. But he didn't. At least, you know, I think we were younger, and I guess, like most parents, they want to protect us. But as I've gotten older, and my father's late now, so I can't ask him. I do think about, how did he manage being in England in those days? And, you know, I think of, you know, my own experience where, you know, everything from my hair to the sort of cliches that were around black men about our noses and our kind of muscular physicality, and having teachers as well as students try and say those things is awful. And I had it, I guess, relatively easy because I was physically very strong. So, you know, no one was physically abusive to me at school. But it still didn't stop the sort of mental trauma, which I still believe is around today. So, you know, as I am a father now, and I look at my girls, it means everything to me to infuse a sense of empathy in the future generations, which is actually, you know, what I saw in the protests in London. It really gave me a lot of hope for the, you know, your daughter's generations. And, you know, I don't think their lived experience will be the same as your parents or even you. If that's the case, then both you and I have failed in some way, right? Because we can't let our children, you know, experience anything like what we've had to grow up with.
Yeah. Misan, when you went through these experiences as a young boy, was the arts one way for you to... Was that your therapy?
Or Massively. It still is today. You know, if I get anxiety, which I do, and I suffer from imposter syndrome, I find solace in songs, in films, in just looking at a picture or a painting, or reading a poem, a quote, or listening to a podcast. It speaks to me in to my inner soul. And I think everyone, if they allow themselves, can experience the same thing. You know, Homo sapiens, one of the truly unique things that separates us from the rest of the natural world is our ability to create art. It's our magic, you know? If you listen to a piece of music or read a book and you know, whole universes are enveloped in your mind, that to me is magical. And I wish more people realized it.
And you know, when you were going through these experiences as a young boy, what was it like culturally at that time? Because, for example, in our community, something like anxiety, depression, or even any sort of fear that you have of going to school, we weren't really, it's not that we weren't allowed to speak up about it. We were just told, get on with it. That's all we were told.
Our cultures are very, very similar. You know, it's like, you know, you're lucky to be in this place. You've got to do it. You have to be better than everyone else. And I think there's a huge stigma today in the South Asian and African communities about mental health. And it's something that, again, I'm being more and more outspoken about because, you know, that I describe so many of my brothers and sisters metaphorically that are from the South Asian and the African communities as a walking wounded, you know, hyper achieving, you know, always kind of professionally doing well, but so many buried things that you know, manifest themselves possibly in later life. And that's something that, again, our children shouldn't have to, you know, we can't repeat those things. And it's not blaming anyone's parents because, you know, think of our parents and the environment they had to survive in, you know, it was always fight or flight for them. So they didn't have time to wonder how, you know, how's the mental health of anyone. It was fight or flight. You know, I have to have food and lodging for my children, make sure that they're educated to the highest level and they can, you know, they can climb higher than I did. Right. And there was no other time for any nuances that we speak with ease about today.
Yeah. No, I think that when we speak about this in years to come to our children, they would probably find it very strange that we were too afraid to speak up about our mental health or to talk about the things that really affected us, because we're creating such a big change now in such a short time within our generation, I feel, that when our kids come, hopefully things will be completely different at that point. But Miss Anne, I want to go into a bit of your photography, because when I went out to protest, Miss Anne, one of the things that we were always trying to figure out was how can we have the most powerful message? We could write letters to our MPs, which we were doing. We can talk about it on social media, which we were doing. But one of the things that my husband and I spoke about a lot was the power of imagery. And if we look at the history of protests and the history of social movements, images is what stays in our head quite a lot. And, you know, you talk about that photo of me outside Downing Street where I was alone. And I think just speaking to you now has made me quite emotional, because it was a very lonely moment for me, you know, that I felt that the world was against me and I was fighting against something that didn't understand me. I was fighting against a system that was not willing to help me or help my brothers and sisters in, across the country. And that image out there, you know, said everything I wanted it to say. How do you make sure that all your photos, you know, send out that powerful message? Because you've taken an incredible amount of photos, especially over the last summer with the protests of Black Lives Matter. What is it that you look for?
You know, it's unique to, as a photographer, to be shooting your own trauma, which is basically what I did for three or four months last year. And I'm still dealing with that now, if I'm being honest with you. But I knew from the first day, and I actually saw what was happening, the first day I went out to shoot the protests, that I had work to do. I also knew that everyone that went out there, when they saw my lens, they gave me a piece of themselves. And it was my responsibility to tell their story truthfully, because the media hasn't always been honest about social movements and protests. And you know, I remember when I gave an interview of, you know, I won't say which media outlet interviewed me. This is during the time I was going out, and you know, it was a perfectly nice interview. And then just out of nowhere, she goes, "So tell me about the violence." And I was like, what violence? I don't, where, you know, I don't know. I've been out a lot and I've seen absolute solidarity, allyship. And for you to presume that I've seen violence because I've been at an anti-racist protest is extraordinary to me. And again, that reminded me why I have to be out there and make sure I capture, truly be this custodian of truth. So I don't look for anything more than what people are willing to give me, right? Mm. So what I think I give the subject is the trust for them to not be afraid to be vulnerable about something that they truly care about, because they know I care about it as much as they do. And that's the difference between, I think, a lot of the other photographers that have been out there over the years, who maybe have been doing it to send to a newspaper, right? To get a scoop, are looking for something that may not tell the story, but may get headline news. That was not what I was looking for to do. I was looking to capture exactly what went down, so my children, once again, children, one day, don't need to ask me, "Daddy, what was it like?" I'll say, "Have a look at this. Sit down, my dears." So it was, and as a black man, It was more than me shooting fashion or brand work. I was fighting for my own life. So of course, wow. I'm going to see compositions that maybe I wouldn't see if I was doing just a regular, you know, a photo shoot with a celebrity or something. This is a different thing.
Yeah. So Miss Anne, when you were out there this summer taking these photos, did this help you with your healing process?
I think at the time, I wouldn't say that it helped me in the moment, because what it did is it unlocked, like so many of us, the trauma we pretended or locked away so deeply of being from another race in a culture that in many ways has institutionalized making life harder for people that look like me and you. We of course have had to lock things away, and we've become so good at locking things away that we forgot where we hid them. And what happened last summer is that it started pouring out of all sorts of different parts of our inner soul. And that is a good thing, but it's also a difficult thing to do during a global pandemic, and everything else that's going on. So it was tough, but I dealt with it by thinking, this is bigger than anything else I've ever done in my life, and this will help me in time heal. And as I'm speaking to you now, so many of the, I call it death by a thousand cuts, the little humiliations, you know, that I've experienced, and the frustrations have slowly and calmly been exiting my good self. So at the time, it felt painful, but now looking back, it was definitely the right thing.
Well, Miss Anne, you know, we're having this conversation, and Radhika sitting here right with me. She can't hear you because I've got my headphones in, but it's making me really emotional because we're having this conversation today. She's 6 months old, and I just wonder what it's going to be like for her when she's 6 years old, when she's 16 years old. I hope this is the kind of conversation that doesn't have to be had at that time. Because you are just one person, I'm just one person, but obviously this is multiplied. There are people across the world who are fighting for the same thing and who have had their own personal traumas that they're also trying to get through as well.
Look at what you did, you know, alone, you know, that lonely figure. And, you know, I look at that image and I literally, my back, like I shivered every, you know, I've looked at it a few times, because it constructs a more powerful message than if there was an army stood outside Downing Street, because it shows the determination of one person that plants a seed into the minds of thousands, if not millions. And, you know, your recent legal wins are part of the seed that you planted as a single soul standing there trying to make a change. So if nothing else happens, and I know more will, Radhika will know and see and hear what her mother did for her and others.
Thank you, Miss Anne. Those are really kind words. And I think I'm going to start crying soon if we keep going down this emotional road. But I remember when we met at Holland Park, I was with my friend who's also a doctor, Seher. She's one of the few who believed in my crazy ideas and supported me throughout this year, especially because everything I have done has been very conventional for a doctor, you know, to go out and protest.
But not just a doctor from your background. I mean, I was going to ask you that later. Either your parents are also former freedom fighters, or you are a very single-minded woman who was like, "F it, I'm doing what I believe in." Which one was it?
it's a difficult question to answer, Miss Anne. No one's really asked me that before, but my parents have been very, very humble. They moved from India to Europe, and they never really. They just try to get on with it, you know, survival mode, as you said. I would always question things when I was younger. I was also told to just get on with it. But I don't know how much you know about our history as a religion. In the Bhagavad Gita, in our religious texts, Lord Krishna was a fighter. He'd always fight for the truth. And my parents always taught me about honesty and the truth. And you know, religion played a big role in our house. And I just thought to myself at that time that, if I don't put this into practice now, then when? Then what's all that use that my parents spent so much time, so much energy teaching me about these great things of our history and our past? It would be a shame not to put that into practice. And it was scary, Miss Anne. You know, South Asian is one thing, but I was pregnant as well.
You're one of a kind, really.
You were out there in those protests when, you know, you saw Black Lives Matter protests, and you know, people were getting arrested. People were being penalized for just speaking the truth. And I was worried that would happen to me. I remember, you know, Nishant put his phone number underneath my scrub top. I've never spoken about this on the podcast, actually. Now that you bring it up, I wrote his number on the sleeve on the inside in case I got arrested. And these are the things that we have to put up with. And that's the only way to say it, Miss Anne. You know, these are the things that we have to think about, the possible consequences of speaking the truth in the 21st century, which I never thought would be the case.
And when you got the Vogue call up, did you think it was a joke?
I thought it was a prank. I had to check the profile and I had to check who this person was. It was Giles, the editor.
Oh, Giles, that's senior. He's a big senior man. Yeah.
And I had to double check everything, and then, you know, I think it's only when I met you that it clicked, because you actually said to me, Masan, you know, you said, you know, people like Michelle Obama read this edition.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand the gravity of what was happening. Because you were so kind and you were so friendly, and Sahara was there to help me. We were just like three people just hanging out, just taking photos, and you know, you made me feel really comfortable. But you'd mentioned to me on that day that it was your wife who who's played a role in encouraging you to pick up your camera and go out there. So before I go into that, how did you meet your wife?
It's really quite boring.
Hoping it'd be a romantic story.
No. It was in Kensington Palace, if that's romantic.
Yeah, that's quite romantic.
At a wedding. Like, it wasn't like on Tinder or, you know, I don't even, you know, it was at a wedding, and, we both knew the bride and groom, and I made a wally out of myself initially, but persisted, and I feel incredibly lucky to meet someone that, I always say we fell in love by feeling our scars like Braille, you know. And what I mean by that is that we opened up to each other at quite an early stage in the courtship about both being, you know, imperfect, and both having been through all sorts of the trials and tribulations that life throws at you. And I feel that was able to cement the kind of bond that even the celestial beings cannot break. And I'm truly thankful. And she also always saw me when I was at my most vulnerable, and found that to be me at my strongest. And I believe that the covers I've shot, the accolades that I've been getting, are about 70% hers, you know.
Wow. But listen, even when you speak about her, it's like you're speaking a poem. You're speaking poetry when you speak about her. It's it's really beautiful to hear, Miss. I can see how much she means to you, because even when you spoke to her about her in Holland Park, I could tell that she's played a big role in encouraging you to go out there and be yourself. Before I go into what happened after Vogue, when Edward Enninful had contacted you, you know, even just now you just mentioned imposter syndrome. This is something that a lot of us this year have faced. A lot of people who've stood up for injustice, who've stood up for our society, who've created change and are receiving positive attention for it.
Mm-hmm.
We feel that we don't deserve it. And personally, from my point, Missan, I feel I don't deserve it. I didn't deserve all this attention, because a part of it felt like my duty as a doctor. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it's like, well, I would have done this anyway, regardless of the result of what came along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think you go through this, Missan? Because a lot of the time, this imposter syndrome can actually become a barrier to us moving forward. So how do you tackle it when you feel this is coming your way?
It's something that I'm living with, that feeling that I don't deserve things, especially when really good things happen. I remember when I got off the Zoom with the team of Vogue and Edward, and they were also so kind to me, and I immediately had a mini panic attack and thought, I can't do this. Like, I'm going to mess it up and they should find somebody else, you know, repeatedly thinking that, up until I saw my wife and she's like, you silly boy, come on. I would say this, at the very depths of self-doubt, and I've said this before, lies a slither of light and hope. And that slither allows you to build a ladder to pull yourself into the daylight. And I think the idea of something is almost always scarier than the thing. So when I actually get to the shoot and I start shooting, I'm absolutely fine. But the idea of shooting the September issue of British Vogue, the idea of being, you know, making history and having the responsibility of making sure Mr. Marcus Rashford and Adwoa Aboah are represented by my lens in the right manner is pretty scary. But not when I got there. So many people who have mental health struggles with things like anxiety and panic attacks and imposter syndrome, and they're all linked. It's the manifestation of not the doing, but the sense of failure that really can't happen, because by the time you've started, you already are not failing. Yeah. By the time you get to the studio or the location, you know, by the time you were at Holland Park and about to meet me and I was about to meet you, that couldn't be a failure, you know. And we need to remind ourselves of that, which can be difficult at some, you know, in certain situations.
And Miss Anne, obviously with everything that's happened this year, I'm sure you have a lot of projects coming up in the future and a lot of things planned, but I feel that your name and your presence has had this is something that will go down in the history books. Your children will read about this and see your name and say, Miss Anne Harriman was the first black photographer in all the years, and Miss Anne Harriman did X, Y, and Z. And at any point, do you feel that sort of pressure that you always have to show up? I've felt that this year there's been every single day a story about social injustice or inequalities. And a part of me feels like I need to talk about it. I need to educate myself. I need to tell my followers about it. I need to be there for every single story. And it can get quite overwhelming. Do you ever have those moments as well?
Yeah. And I go to my safe place, the arts, you know. There's a Rumi quote that I quote quite a lot, which is, raise your words, not your voice. It is rain that grows flowers, not thunder. Especially the last line, it is rain that grows flowers, not thunder. And for me, I look at that to say, yes, the world, you know, has always been burning one way or another. But sometimes we need to take a step back and be measured in what we want to fight for. We should never stop fighting, but take a stance and just look at everything from a bird's eye view and be sure what you want to dedicate your platform to. And my whole family got COVID over Christmas, and you know, my daughters, my wife and I, my kids were fine, and Camilla and I weren't so good, and I was the worst. And in those 3 weeks of being pretty sick at home, but not great, I had this zen-like, almost out-of-body experience where I truly thought about what matters. And it's made me in a way be more focused to not take any BS in regards to what I want in regards to civil rights, the anti-racist movement, mental health, disability rights, all of that, but also to not want to please everyone and do everything and every interview and run around. So that moment of absolute meditative contemplation of who I am has helped me hopefully be a little bit clearer in what I decide to do or not. Or not do in 2021.
Yeah, that's great, Miss, and I'm glad that you had that time to switch off. Obviously, not in the nicest way possible with COVID, but I feel that this year has been so overwhelming for so many of us that we do need to take a moment to just figure out our role in society, because all of us have something to give. If we just take a moment to see what assets do we have, and what can we give to society, and play, because now with social media, it almost feels like everyone wants to talk about everything. There's so much going on. Everybody has to have an opinion about something.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's not the case. Sometimes you just have to let other people do what they're good at, and you do what you're good at.
Yes.
Miss Anne, I'm going to ask you a question, because someone asked me this question a few days ago, and I was like, wow, I don't know how to answer this. I want to see if you'd be able to answer it. So if you were Prime Minister, what would you change?
If I was Prime Minister, I would invest even 5% of what is spent on defence into the NHS, and it would make this country probably the best health-caring nation in the world.
Mm.
I would double down on everything Marcus Rashford's doing with free school meals, and make sure the general health of the nation from children is democratized. You know, so you know it's the correlation between children whose parents are from tough socioeconomic backgrounds and them having obesity and health issues is clear. I would have a look at the prison industrial complex, and also, again, the socioeconomic stories of repeat offenders and the fact that it is not working, how young men and women are not getting what they need. I mean, I could go on all day.
We should do another podcast episode, just called "If Miss Anne Was Prime Minister."
but you know, a few more things. I would definitely speak to the countries that it's clear, you know, people like Jacinta Ardern and other leaders that have somehow managed to get the tone of the nation right whilst leading as well. So you know, have discourse with leaders that seem to be getting it right. And also look at the government, both ruling party and otherwise, and have a look at why there are not enough diverse voices in both the Labour and Conservative Party, and invest in that as well, because that is the tapestry that makes this United Kingdom great. And invest in the arts.
Okay.
Invest in the arts, theatre land, museums, and make them available to all.
Well, I think, Miss Anne, you know, you made so many amazing points there about what things that you would change, but I also feel that a lot of these things can still be changed at a ground level.
Mm.
You know, I spoke to Femi a few weeks ago. He's very active about talking about Brexit, and he told me, he said, well, I feel I can bring more change by talking about Brexit for 10 minutes on the TV than actually being at number 10, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the incredible power we have as activists and campaigners and people like yourself on the ground, that we have things like social media to create change and to change people's minds.
Well, look what Marcus did. Look what you did.
Exactly. Miss Anne, before I go, because I can tell Radhika can't actually hear you, so she's got no idea what's going on. She just sees a face. so she doesn't really understand what's going on, but I will need to put her to bed soon. But
she's a vision. Oh my God.
you know,
it's the closest, it doesn't matter what religion anyone is, but I honestly believe that children are as close as you get to understanding that there is something beyond us, you know, and before the world gets to them. So, you know, between now and let's say one even, right? Yeah. There's it's not just innocence. There's something that's from another place. And it's just enjoy this time. I really mean that, Mina.
I agree, Miss Anne. And you know, it's just the small things that she's happy with the smallest of things that I give her. I get the most beautiful smile when I just tickle her, and you realize they just haven't been contaminated by the external material.
I mean,
world
she's looking
yet
at your headphone lead like it's a Picasso. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it won't be as beautiful when she pulls it down, but let's hope it doesn't get there. But Miss Anne, I mean, I'm holding Radhika now. She's just looking at me, and she's staring at me, looking me in the eye, and this is a moment that I've always thought about, that one day she will look at me in the eye and say, Mummy, what did you do in the pandemic?
What did you do? Yeah.
How did you help? And what kind of legacy do you want to leave behind for your children? I mean, when your children grow up, I know it's a very difficult question to answer because things are changing every day, the world is changing, but what do you want to teach your two daughters?
That I lived my life with humility and empathy. And those are the two ingredients that are the mother of hope. And with hope, there's change. And if my children can have empathy, if they have empathy, it means they'll be activists, because it's impossible to be an activist if you don't have empathy. If they have humility, they will know that no matter how successful, whatever they want to be in life, they are no better than people that haven't had the advantages that they have. And I love that combination of traits. So if they see that their father tried to the best of his ability to be that person, hopefully they can take that baton and take it to another level altogether.
That's wonderful, Mehsan. And you know, you just mentioned taking the baton, and I think that's the only thing I want to do, to start the conversation and then pass the baton on to Radhika and to your daughters and say, here, you can take it forward as you wish. And thank you so much for joining me, Mehsan.
No, thank you.
I wish we could talk about a lot more, but it's getting late.
This is the coolest interview, because you've brought your beautiful, beautiful daughter to honour us with our presence, and it's made this even more enjoyable. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mehsan. I'm so glad that we could reconnect. Yes. After meeting at Holland Park, and it's just so surreal to have Radhika in my arms when she was in my womb when you photographed us together.
She's so chilled. If this was any of my daughters, that this wouldn't have been, it would have been over a long time ago. The camera would be broken, they'll be screaming. I mean, wow.
I think she's used to the camera. I think, Mehsan, well, you did some magic to her that she just knows what the camera is.
Yeah. Well, it's late as well, so she's chilled, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mehsan.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. And thank you, Mehsan, as well, for your time. I know you're being pulled left, right, and center, not just with your photography, but with your two young girls as well. So I appreciate all the time that you've given to me. And if you want to get in touch with me, you can on Instagram or on Twitter. You can just drop me a message at Meenal's World, and I'm always happy to connect with you. And I'm always grateful for everybody who listens into the podcast and shows me their love and support. I'll see you all next week.